Okay, if we can start. Our speaker tonight, Gavin Davis, is somebody who almost needs no introduction. I think by common consent he's regarded as the best of the city economists. Gavin worked in Downing Street under the Labour government. When did you start there?
Prehistory.
Anyway, the late 70s, before Thatcher, BT. Since then has been in the city and is now managing director at Goldman Sachs. He's a member of the Treasury's panel of independent forecasters, or commonly known as the Seven Wise Men. He's one of the few members of that panel who actually deserves the epithet wise. So, Gavin.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming. Do you all have a copy of this? What I'm going to attempt to do, if you don't, please go and get one outside because you need one. But what I'm going to attempt to do is try and, in about half an hour, 40 minutes, try and take you through the reasoning that I think lay behind the fiscal tightening that was announced on Tuesday. The Chancellor announced a fiscal tightening of around 1% of GDP, mostly coming on the tax side, some of it coming on some rather questionable public spending cuts. He felt he needed to do this in order to control the borrowing requirement and keep the PSBR down. PSBR means the government borrowing requirement, public sector borrowing requirement, so the budget deficit. And I'd just like to really try and explain to you why he thought he needed to do that. I should say at the beginning that I thought he needed to do that as well, so you're not going to get a critical analysis of the budget from me, at least in terms of its macroeconomic effects. You're going to get an analysis which is fairly in tune with mainstream Treasury thinking, for what it's worth, this evening. Now, the first five or six pages of the handout you've got are all done on pre-budget arithmetic. So all the numbers are prior to the changes that were announced on Tuesday. And I did that in order to take you through the logic that I think applied in the Treasury. First point to make is that the PSBR is very high. You can see that here, it's pretty obvious. As a percentage of GDP, it's only really once been higher in the middle of the 1970s. And you need a pretty rapid rate of growth of activity from now on in order to eliminate the PSBR by sometime in the late 1990s. The forecasts that Treasury must have been looking at prior to the budget indicates that on a base case, which is 2.8% GDP growth over the medium term, the PSBR would come down probably to around 3.5%, 3.75% of GDP by the time the economy returns to trend capacity working in about 1997. And that, I think, is still a fairly high number. It's not outlandishly high, but it was one reason why the Treasury probably started to get somewhat concerned. The makeup of the borrowing requirement is actually pretty different from what it was last time we had this kind of a crisis. And the reason is, if you look here at the central government, you can see that virtually the whole of the borrowing requirement now, in fact, I think the whole of it, is due to central government borrowing, and the public corporations and the local authorities, who in the mid-1970s contributed quite a lot to the borrowing requirement, this time are not contributing anything to the borrowing requirement. So this was very much a central government problem. Very hard for the Treasury to offload this problem and say it's all the local authorities' fault or it's the public corporations' fault, which they would have loved to have been able to have done, but unfortunately they couldn't. It was very much a central government issue. So that was one thing that I think focused thinking in terms of dealing with it through a tax change in particular impacting the CGBR, the central government borrowing requirement. In addition to that, there were two other reasons for being maybe somewhat more concerned about this episode of high borrowing than was the case in the past. The first was that the government's primary deficit, that is its deficit excluding debt interest, which is very important in terms of the sustainability of government debt, as we'll see in a minute, the primary deficit was much, much worse this time than it was in the middle of the 1970s. In fact, the primary deficit, which is this dotted line, was running at about 5% of GDP last year, or in fact this year, whereas the last time the government was in very, very big deficit in the mid-1970s, a lot of that was due to debt interest, and the primary balance was actually only just in deficit. So, excluding interest payments, the government moved into a very, very heavy deficit position very quickly in the latter part of the 1980s. And, as I say, in a minute I'll show you why that's important in terms of the sustainability of government debt. Makes it a lot harder to control the government's outstanding ratio of debt to GDP. By comparison with other countries, the primary deficit last year of about 5% of GDP, or this year of about 5% of GDP, I think is among the highest primary deficits in the European community. Even countries like Italy, which have very substantial borrowing problems, as we all know, and have a government deficit overall of around 10 or 11% of GDP, they do not have a primary deficit of anything like this size. In fact, Italy has a primary surplus. So that was another reason for getting somewhat concerned that things were slightly out of control. And I think more importantly, the second factor that was really starting to get concerning to people was that we are now eroding a lot less debt through inflation than we did in the mid-1970s. Again, when we were running a very, very high budget deficit in the mid-1970s, we had a very high rate of inflation in double digits for most of that period. So we were, and also it was higher than the rate of interest, so we were eroding a great deal of debt through the high rate of inflation, which meant we could borrow a lot from one year to the next without adding anything to the debt-to-GDP ratio, because the denominator, GDP, in nominal terms, was rising so fast. So look at this histogram here. This is the erosion of public sector debt through inflation. And you can see that it's now down to a very low number, partly because there's so little inflation, partly because outstanding debt is actually quite low, as we'll see in a minute. But we are not eroding very much at all of our government debt through inflation. So it is much, much more dangerous. If we have a high primary deficit now, excluding interest payments, it's much, much more difficult to control the debt ratio in a low inflation environment. One of the few advantages of inflation is that it makes high public borrowing less immediately dangerous. Although high public borrowing, of course, in developing countries often will trigger the inflation in the first place, and it can also happen sometimes in developed countries. Certainly if you work in the other direction, high inflation helps you control debt ratios, and that isn't happening right now in the UK because of our low inflation rate. So we were looking in the UK at a situation where the PSBR was high. Most of that was coming through the central government, with very little of it from public corporations or local authorities. Simultaneously, very little of it was debt interest, or relatively little. It was mainly a primary budget deficit. and we were eroding a very small proportion of that debt each year by inflation, which made it much harder to control. Now, the offset to all those worrying points is that, fortunately, the outstanding debt ratio in Britain is actually still pretty low. So although all those points indicate it probably is increasing rapidly, in fact it is, it's doing so from a low base. I'll show you that now. What happened in the 70s essentially was that we inflated the deficit down, the debt ratio down. GDP continually increased very rapidly because of inflation, nominal GDP, and in the meantime, nominal interest rates generally, as I say, stayed below the inflation rate. So it was very, very easy to reduce the public sector debt ratio. Just kept falling. Then in the latter part of the 80s, for a very short period of time, the UK had a budget surplus. So it genuinely paid off debt. It didn't simply inflate down the debt ratio, but it actually genuinely paid down debt for, I think, about 3 years in succession, one year of which was a very big budget surplus. So by the time this recent recession hit, the ratio of debt to GDP was down somewhere in the mid-30s in the UK. And if you compare that with other European countries, it's pretty low. Most European countries in the early 90s were running debt ratios of somewhere around 50 or 60%, and several of them were up at 70, 80, 90 plus. Belgium's up at about 120 or 130, Italy's about 110, and then there are quite a few countries between 50 and 100. So a debt ratio of 35 is pretty low. Many people take the view that with a debt ratio this low, 35% of GDP, it doesn't really matter how fast you increase that debt ratio, because public debt is so low relative to income in an international context that you can afford a substantial period of rising debt. Now, one thing that focused me against thinking like that, and I think also has focused the government against it, is just looking what happened to several European countries in the 80s. Because actually, if you look at countries like Italy and Belgium and Ireland and Sweden, all of whom now have very, very heavy debt ratios and extreme difficulty in controlling their government accounts as a result, none of them, if you go back 10 or 12 years, had anything like the problem they now have. They let it slip very quickly in a period of about 3 or 4 years from a manageable situation with low debt to an unmanageable situation with very high debt. And once you get into that position, you're paying about 10% often of your national income in debt interest, in public sector debt interest. Admittedly, most of this is a transfer between sectors internally, because most of it is not external debt, but nevertheless, it's a very, very big transfer payment for the government to handle each year. And it can easily become, or it can become under some conditions, explosive. The Italians have now spent 4 or 5 years with really draconian cutbacks in public spending and draconian increases in taxation designed to control a debt ratio which got out of hand in the 1980s, similarly in other countries in Europe as well. And by and large, I mean, as a first approximation, I would say that the sooner you control a potential situation like this pessimistic case, the better. The pessimistic case, remember, is based on only low GDP growth of about 1.75% per annum. But, you know, looking at this, there is clearly a risk that GDP growth will be low over the medium term. It could quite easily be 2% or less over the medium term. And if that had happened, then a very, very sharp increase in the debt ratio would have occurred, taking the debt ratio up to about 70% of GDP over a 4 or 5 year timescale. Now, the change in policy that the government has introduced now hasn't done a hell of a lot to avoid that, but it has at least moved things slightly in a into a lower debt environment. It hasn't made a huge difference to these numbers. If we get into a pessimistic case, the tax increases that have been announced this time are not going to be all that large relative to this explosion in debt that would take place under those circumstances. But nevertheless, you know, as I say, it's moved policy in the direction of that makes it somewhat less likely we'll get into this pessimistic case on the debt ratio. Now, faced with this kind of arithmetic, these kind of figures, the government had to choose how much to tighten budgetary policy. And I think their thinking probably went through two stages. The first was to try and calculate what had to be done to the budget in order to achieve a sustainable debt position by the late 1990s. And by sustainable debt position, I mean that the debt ratio flattens out and then after that stays flat, so debt rises in line with GDP. So question number one is, what does the government need to do to the budget in order to stabilise its debt position by the end of the parliament? That is, I think, an insufficient question to ask. I mean, there are many other questions you could ask on top of that question. But that is at least a starting point. I'll just show you now how the answer is developed. In order to do this, I'm not going to have a slide on this, so we need to go to page, I think, 4 of this document, or is it 3? I've just sketched out in very simple terms on page 3 how the government's budget constraint works and how you can manipulate it to get a relationship, which I've called equation 6 at the bottom. Essentially, all this says is that unless the government prints money, unless it creates high-powered money, one day it's going to need to tax to cover all of its spending. You can manipulate this in lots and lots of different ways, but if you look at this, if you look through this later, I'm not going to take you through the algebra, which is very, very simple, but if you look at it later, you'll see that equation 6 there essentially says the following. F is the primary surplus. It says that the primary government surplus is related to, needs to be related in steady state with a sustainable debt position, needs to be related to the real rate of interest minus the real rate of economic growth, R minus Y, multiplied by the outstanding ratio of debt to GDP, which is B. And then there's another term there which actually relates to the degree of monetization that you can get away with a given inflation rate. Now that second term, Y plus P minus V, or all over big V, in the UK is very small. Because in the UK, big V, which is the velocity of circulation of high-powered money, is about 30. So bottom line is, in Britain, we don't create... The monetary base in Britain is very, very small. So that if we try and... if we allow the monetary base to grow in line with inflation, say inflation target is 4%, we allow the money base to grow in line with inflation, we don't actually end up creating much high-powered money, and that doesn't finance much of our budget deficit. In some other countries where there's a much bigger monetary base and where they've been financing their deficits for many more years through increases in high-powered money, that term, that second term on the right-hand side of equation 6, you would need to take account of. But in the UK, you don't, because there isn't very much high-powered money in the system, okay? So really it comes down to, if we ignore that first, second term, it really comes down to the primary surplus is equal to B times R minus Y. So obviously if the real rate of interest is higher than the real rate of economic growth, which it is at the moment, then you need to have a primary surplus. It's pretty straightforward that. Look at page 4. And I put it in a little box there, which I've called table 1. Essentially the same relationship. It's pretty much exactly the same relationship. Focusing only on the first part of that relationship, R minus YB. Now the key thing about this is, obviously, that you get a different primary surplus for each value of B. So if you choose, you can choose any outstanding debt ratio you like from 0 to 200, and you will get, or 400, whatever you choose, you will get a primary surplus which will make that a sustainable debt position. So this doesn't tell you what the optimal level of debt to hold is. It just says if you want to hold a debt ratio of 50% of GDP forever, and if the real rate of interest is R and the real rate of growth is Y, then you need to have a primary surplus of F. And F is going to be higher the higher the debt ratio. But you can have a sustainable debt position in this sense at any debt ratio. The debt ratio could be 200 and it can still be sustainable as long as you have a big enough primary surplus. Okay? Now at the moment, as I said, in about 3 or 4 years' time, the government will have got to a debt to GDP ratio probably of around 52%, and that's what I've plugged into this equation here. And then I've put R and Y at their approximate recent trend values. And what you end up with is that the government needs to have a primary surplus for debt sustainability of about 1 percentage point of GDP. So it needs the non-interest surplus in the budget to be around 1% of GDP. Now, in addition to that, to get to the PSBR, to get to the proper government deficit, we have to add debt interest, okay? And debt interest is obviously related in the long term to the rate of interest. And that is related to the inflation rate. So the PSBR target you end up with is related to the inflation rate. It's related crucially to the real rate of interest, the real rate of growth in the economy, the end point you choose for the debt ratio, and also it is related to the inflation rate via the debt interest that you have to add to the primary surplus. The little table I've called Table 2 on page 4 shows what the result is for the PSBR under three different inflation assumptions, 1%, 2.5% and 4%, which is the bottom, the middle and the top of the government's target range for inflation. So if we assume the government wants to hit the middle of its target range by 1997, 2.5%, then this arithmetic says to achieve debt sustainability, the government needs to borrow, get a borrowing requirement by 97 of 2.5% of GDP. Remember what we said at the beginning, it's currently around 8.75% of GDP. That is the debt sustainability arithmetic. Now, I said at the beginning it wasn't sufficient. It's not sufficient for lots of different reasons. I mean, you can take a Keynesian view of this and say, you can make a Keynesian case for a much bigger build-up of debt on the grounds that over the medium term that will leave you with much more output in the system. You can also ask a separate question which is related to the government's balance sheet more generally, which is the following. What I've done so far is I've just looked at the debt side of the balance sheet. And I think most people would admit that you should look at the asset side of the balance sheet as well. And you should say the rate of growth of debt, the amount the government borrows, ought to be related to how much it invests. Because if the government is investing in real capital, an amount X, it can afford to put that amount of extra debt onto the balance sheet and still end up with its net worth unchanged. And any company or individual doing that would be perfectly solvent. So, simply looking at the liability side of the balance sheet is probably insufficient. We need to look at the asset side of the balance sheet as well. And we need to ask what the government is doing on the asset side of its balance sheet. Now, if you turn over to page 5, we're now coming into the territory known as the golden rule of public finance, which isn't really very closely related to the golden rule that you've probably learnt about in growth theory. I think if I was stretching my imagination, I could probably think of some ways in which the two things are related, but I do think it's a bit of a stretch. The golden rule of public finance, which is very widely used in continental Europe, in Central Europe in particular, in Germany and other Germanic countries in Central Europe, simply states, as it is generally used in Europe, that the government's borrowing requirement should be equal to its net addition to its capital stock. And if that's the case, then if you accumulate that over time, what you will find is the capital stock, the outstanding stock of capital, will be equal to the government debt. So one way of deciding what B should be, remember if we will go back to that equation we saw a minute ago, I said that you could pick any old B you liked. One way of selecting the B that you want to choose is by equating that with the government's stock of real capital and saying the government then has net worth of zero. Now actually it's rather unclear to me why the government should have net worth of zero, but it's probably at least a sensible thing to think about. Certainly in flow terms, if the government is investing a great deal in motorways and hospitals and schools, etc., it can probably afford to build up debt more rapidly than otherwise. Now there are two, I mean I've probably overcomplicated this by looking at this golden rule principle in two ways, and I've called them the wide definition and the narrow definition. I'll just tell you what they are, although I don't think you really need to focus all that much on these two definitions. The wide definition of this is simply to say that the government can borrow extra each year the same amount that it adds to the nation's stock of capital. The narrow definition is to say the government can borrow each year the amount that it adds to its own stock of capital, the public sector stock of capital. The difference between these two things is largely transfers of assets between the public and the private sector. A transfer of assets between the public and the private sector, say a privatization, is going to reduce the government's stock of assets, but it's going to increase somebody else's stock of assets. So on the wide definition of this, it wouldn't have any effect on the PSBR that you come out with at the other end, and I think that's probably the more appropriate way of looking at it. The graph not named, called the Golden Rule on page 5, just shows you how far away the government has recently been from fulfilling this golden rule. Because, remember what I said, let's take this wide, let's forget this narrow definition, just take the wide definition of public asset creation. This is the amount each year that the government adds to the nation's stock of capital through its investment activities and also through its support for private sector investment and its privatization program. I've allowed for all of these things in this definition. In order to meet the golden rule of public finance, you have to borrow less than you're adding to assets. Now the government, for much of the early part of the 80s, was borrowing, the histogram shows the amount they're borrowing. The government was borrowing a lot more than it was adding to assets, and again recently it's been borrowing a very, very great deal more than it's been adding to assets. So it's been missing the golden rule by a very large amount. That indicates that the net worth of the public sector should have been going down. It's adding more to its financial liabilities than it is adding to its assets. And over time, you know, you can ask questions in a democracy whether taxpayers are going to really want to service the debt, because over a very long period of time, as if the debt built up in this way with no offsetting gain in assets, you get two potential dangers might develop. The first is the financial markets might start asking questions about what the government was doing with its money. It's all current spending. Markets may start saying this is all current spending. None of this is going into investment. Why should we lend to an entity which is not building up its stock of capital but is simply spending a great deal of money on current spending? And the second thing is that the taxpayer may start saying, well, you know, I've got to service all this debt in the future. Am I actually getting a flow of services back from the government which makes me feel comfortable with the additional taxes I'm going to have to pay in the long term to service the debt? So these two things might make you concerned if you are simply building up your stock of financial liabilities and you're not building up your asset base. Certainly if you were a company, if you were a private company, you would have to get concerned about this, because the stock market and the capital markets would make you concerned about it. Sooner or later they would make you concerned about it. If you're the government, you've got a lot more leeway, because at the end of the day you have one very large intangible asset, which is the right to tax. And as long as you've got the right to tax, that is a very hard thing to value. But the government's right to tax can probably mean that it can worsen its balance sheet position for a very, very long period of time without anyone really worrying about it. It's not like a private company. But I think in terms of good public finance, you may well want to worry about it. And if you're interested in the golden rule, you certainly would want to worry about it. Now, the British government has indeed been running down its net worth rather remarkably in the past few years. And for those of you that were trying to travel on the Central Line last Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday or Monday, you won't need me to tell you that it might have been a good idea had we put some wires into the Central Line at some point after 1920, but we didn't, apparently. And that is just one tiny example of how the net worth of the public sector has started to be eroded. You can see it on this graph. What I've done on this graph is I've shown you the tangible assets of the public sector. These things are real capital, the valuation of real capital, and the financial debt of the public sector, and then its net worth. Now, what's happened since the early 1980s is that the tangible assets relative to GDP have started to go down. It's partly because they were sold off in privatization, but it's partly also because investment by the public sector has been fairly low for a long time. Tangible assets have been going down. For a lot of the 1980s, the financial debt fell as well, so the net worth didn't do very much. But in the recent past, with the recession adding to financial debt, you have suddenly had a very, very big drop in the net worth of the public sector. Now, as I say, the net worth of public sectors can easily go negative. I mean, there's nothing magic about keeping this positive, but the net worth has been dropping pretty sharply. And I think it's a symptom of overconsumption. I mean, you can look at this in lots of different ways in the UK economy. But in lots and lots of different ways, the UK economy has been overconsuming. And this is one symptom, or consequence, I guess, of overconsuming in the public sector. So, we're going back now to the handout, which, let's go to page 7. I've now established two ways of answering the question: how much should the government borrow in the long run, in the medium term and long run. Method one of answering it is to say, well, let's just make sure that they get into a sustainable debt position, and who cares about assets? As long as the debt position is sustainable, that'll be okay. And on that basis, the PSBR required for debt sustainability at the end of this parliament, 1997-98, we established was about 2.5% of GDP, slightly higher with a higher inflation rate, slightly lower with a lower inflation rate, but about 2.5% of GDP with inflation in the middle of the target band. And then separately we asked the second question, which is, okay, that's fine for debt sustainability, but what would the government need to do to achieve the golden rule of public finance? How much would it need to borrow in order to ensure that its balance sheet stopped worsening, that it was building up assets in line with its liabilities? And by coincidence, the answer happens to be the same, which is about 2.5% to 3% of GDP again. Now, I say by coincidence because if the government were investing a great deal more, then, say the government were investing 6% of GDP each year, then it could borrow 6% of GDP in steady state and meet the golden rule. It so happens that on my calculations it's investing about 2.5% of GDP in a very I'm being very generous to the government here, so maybe between 1.5% and 2.5% of GDP. So that's what it can borrow at the end of the day in order to meet the golden rule. So it turns out, by coincidence, that the same answer crops up from both ways of answering, of asking the question, which is that by the time the economy returns to trend, it needs to borrow about 2.5% of GDP. Now, the next question is, okay, fine, how much is it actually going to borrow when it returns to trend? And the answer to that, of course, depends on a forecast for the economy, forecast for spare capacity, a forecast for what's going to happen to the government accounts between now and the time we get back to trend. If we assume we're going to get back to trend in about 97, 98, which would happen approximately if we had 3% GDP growth between now and then on the models that most people are using prior to the budget, as you can see here, the little table at the top of page 7, the PSBR would go down to about 3.5% of GDP on the base case for GDP by 97-98. Now, that is about a percentage point higher than the PSBR that's required for the golden rule or for debt sustainability. And the government decided to tighten budgetary policy by about 1 percentage point of GDP in year 3 and year 4, which actually brings them after the budget, remember these are pre-budget numbers, it brings them after the budget down to a PSBR level at the end of the parliament, which is approximately 2.5% of GDP or thereabouts, and therefore both meets the debt sustainability point and meets the golden rule. Now, all that sounds very convincing, I hope, except that you should note the degree of uncertainty in these numbers. The degree of uncertainty in PSBR projections, you know, I mean, the degree of uncertainty in any projections, even going ahead a year, is very, very pronounced. But the PSBR in particular is a very uncertain series. And if you plug in really only small differences in the growth rate in the economy over 3 or 4 years, you will get huge differences in the PSBR at the end of the period. The optimistic base and pessimistic cases assume, I think the optimistic case is, if I remember rightly, 3.3% growth in GDP, the base is 2.8, and the pessimistic is 1.8, and you can see that that encompasses an outturn for the PSBR in 4 years' time, which differs from 1% of GDP on the one hand, on the optimistic case, to 9% of GDP on the pessimistic case. So the truth of the matter is that we are in a hugely uncertain environment where we do not know within a very large margin of error whether tax increases were really necessary to achieve debt sustainability and the golden rule or not. Could well have been that without these tax increases you would still have achieved the golden rule easily over 3 or 4 years' time. You would still achieve debt sustainability easily. Or it could well be that even with the tax increases you're going to be miles away from achieving it. So looked at in that sense, it must have been very tempting for the Chancellor to say, well, to hell with these figures, they're too uncertain, I'm not going to stand up and announce tax increases. I think the reason that he decided to do it was partly an assessment of risk. I think he probably felt that this was the last chance politically to increase taxes in this Parliament. I think he probably felt that the financial markets would be rather kinder to a Chancellor who had made some move to improve the public financial position if things were to go wrong later. But I'm sure he would readily agree that the change he has introduced in the budget is only a very small proportion of what could turn out to be needed if the economy behaves badly over the medium term. The other point I would make is that if you look at page 7 and look at the second graph, the middle exhibit on page 7, the graph there in the middle, one factor which everybody's now focusing on in the UK is we are consuming a lot of our national income. Total personal disposable income is at an all-time high, or very nearly an all-time high, in the UK as a result partly of all the tax cuts we had in the 80s. And in addition, we've spent quite a lot of that in consumption, so the consumer spending to GDP ratio is also quite high. It's probably at a 20 or 30 year high. It's been rising ever since the latter part of the 1970s. And any tax increase is a good idea in that environment, well, maybe a good idea in that environment, in terms of trying to get this consumption ratio back down again. The high rate of consumption, the high consumption ratio, has had two corollaries. First is that investment is actually rather a low percentage of GDP at the moment. So one has to question whether the rate of growth of consumption could be maintained with the capital stock that we're building up over time. And secondly, some of this consumption, some of this rising consumption as share of GDP, has worsened the current account, the balance of payments. Net exports have been squeezed out by this increase in consumption. If you look at the little graph at the bottom of page 7, you can't see this all that clearly from that graph. But one of the things that is true in the UK at the moment is that the current account of the balance of payments, the trade deficit, is in an unusually adverse state for this stage of the economic cycle. In fact, usually in a recession, the trade account has gone into surplus. This time, at the base of the recession, the trade account remained in deficit by around 1 or 1.5% of GDP, which means that if the UK goes through its usual deterioration in trade in the course of the economic recovery, it is going to find potentially a big deterioration in trade and potentially a financial problem. If that then means that the UK has to grow more slowly in order to control the trade deficit, you're going to be straight back into a budget problem. Because, for example, if the trade deficit deteriorated on a 3% growth path for GDP, and that then implied the government had to choke off the growth rate, tighten policy to give us a 2% growth rate in GDP, it would get much, much harder to control the debt ratio. Now, one way of trying to address the trade problem without causing inflation is to tighten up on the fiscal side and to ease up on the monetary side, and I think that's what the government's been doing since leaving the ERM. In the ERM, they were doing the opposite, but outside the ERM, they've been tightening up on the fiscal side and easing on the monetary side. The corollary of that is that they will keep the exchange rate reasonably competitive and will try and deal with the trade problem over the medium term by doing that. And that will make it more likely that they will be able to control public debt. So I think abstracting from any issues that you may have with the uncertainty of this arithmetic and with debt sustainability and the government golden rule points that I've been mentioning, there are other reasons for changing the mix between fiscal and monetary policy. One is this share of consumption in GDP, which is very high, and the second is the need to control the trade deficit, which could probably best be done. If you read your textbooks, you will find that, generally speaking, the recommended route to controlling a trade deficit is to, or one route anyway, is to devalue the real exchange rate, as long as you can get the real exchange rate down, not the nominal exchange rate, which you've got to doubt, but if you can get the real exchange rate down and combine that with a tighter fiscal stance. This is the classic approach which, you know, we've seen in many developing countries over many years. We've seen it in the UK, we've seen it in Italy. It's the IMF package, tighter fiscal policy linked with easier monetary conditions quite often, and a devaluation in the exchange rate to get out of a current account problem. So I think that those two factors, the excess consumption and the trade problem, are further points tending to push the government in thinking about making a change in its policy mix in the direction that we've seen. Final thing I would say is that I've not talked at all here about the borderline of the state. And of course you can make political value judgments about the size of the state, and those again, to many people at the moment, feel that the desire to cut taxes in the latter part of the 1980s went too far, partly caused our PSBR problem, has caused a rundown in our public services, has caused underinvestment in the state, in the government sector, and that needs to be redressed. But those points I haven't been making here today. I happen to believe in them, but I haven't been making them because I think they are essentially political points. The bottom line of what I'd just like to finish with is to say what the government has now managed to achieve through the budgetary tightening that it's done. It is probable, I think, that through two successive budgets of big fiscal tightening, March 1993 and November 1993, which together add up to about 3 percentage points of GDP of fiscal tightening, and I can't offhand remember a bigger UK fiscal tightening than this, it's very, very big, I think that they've done two things. The first is that they have greatly increased the likelihood of being in a debt-sustainable position and meeting the golden rule of public finance by the latter part of the parliament. They haven't made it certain, but they could never do that. They've greatly increased the likelihood that that would be the case. And secondly, and probably more importantly in some senses, they've started to redress the overconsumption in the economy, which I think has taken hold in the late 1980s, and also redress perhaps the balance of payments problem, which threatened to become really quite serious over the medium term without a policy adjustment of this type. So I think they've gone in the right direction. I'll have to wait and see whether they've done enough. Thanks very much. That's absolutely true. Have a look at the back page, the inside back cover of this publication. What we saw in the top left graph shows personal incomes and personal savings and consumption, just as a share of GDP, and this is just done in nominal terms. You get slightly different picture if you do it in real terms, but nothing dramatic. The interesting thing, as you say, is that consumption did very well in the boom of the 1980s. The share of consumption increased markedly, as you would probably expect in a boom period. But in the recession from 1990 to 1993, we did not see the share of consumption coming down at all. And actually, there was only, if you look at the level of real consumption, there was only a 2% or 2.5% drop in the level of real consumption. So consumer spending, for all that people say about consumer debt, the housing market, all of that, consumer spending remained very robust in this recession. And I mean, I don't know how to explain it, really. I'm not sure why that happened. But what got squeezed, if you look at the bottom left graph, was investment. The investment share in the economy really collapsed between 1989 and 1993. And we're now looking at investment, either in the private sector or in the government sector, or in total rather, which is lower than it's been in previous, the troughs of previous economic cycles.
That was one thing, and of course the other thing was the trade balance stayed more adverse than it normally does. I'm sure there are very, very large numbers of people working on consumption functions trying to explain why consumers' expenditure has remained so high. But I don't think you've got all that far to look for a clue, which is what's happened to personal incomes. Personal incomes have remained very robust in this recession. And although savings went up during the recession, and that caused a lot of the recession, personal disposable income growth remained very strong. And I think, again, you know, some of that is due to the tax cuts of the 80s, which came through and boosted personal incomes. So to some extent, I think we've seen here an effect of lower taxation. The lower taxes of 1986 to 1988, which probably boosted personal disposable income by about, 6 to 8%. That I think has probably contributed to the robustness of consumption in the recession phase. But it is a bit of a puzzle, I think. Yeah. The role that consumption could play in the recovery, that's a very, very interesting question, because so far the economic recovery from the beginning of 1992 to the present has been very consumer dominated. Investment has been broadly flat over that period. There hasn't been much of a turnaround in stocks. There's been some, but not as much as usual. And the growth in domestic demand has been actually pretty dominated by consumer spending. Now, what's going to happen now with these tax increases that I'm sounding so enthusiastic about is that the consumer is going to have probably 2 or 3 years of relatively subdued real income growth. In my view, next year, it will actually see real incomes going down as a result of the tax increases that are being planned. As that occurs, the only way that domestic demand is going to remain robust, if we wanted to, I mean, let's say at 2% growth rate for domestic demand, the only way we're going to get that is if personal savings come down. So we've got to be able to assume, I think, that personal savings are going to come down. Now, they have started to come down. In the last 3 quarters, we've seen a drop in the personal savings ratio for the first time in about 4 or 5 years. So they've started to come down, but they're going to need to drop substantially further right through next year and the year after to maintain consumers' expenditure growth in the recovery. And clearly there's no question that this kind of fiscal adjustment reduces the chances of a sustained pickup fueled by domestic demand. I mean, that's essentially what it's intended to do, in a sense. So there's no question that it will do that. And the counter case to the one I've put today is that is too risky. And that with our debt ratio as low as it is, in the kind of low 40s at the moment, we could afford 3 or 4 years of just leaving things be and address the PSBR problem later, because it's too risky to the recovery to do that. Now, that is the opposing case. I think I'm going to trespass on ground where I'm even less expert than I normally trespass if I answer that question. I don't know about the benefit structure for the unemployed, so I think I'll just pass on that. The question, though, of whether unemployment is the government doing enough to reduce unemployment? The obvious answer to that is no. I mean, the Labour Party got itself into a tremendous fuss in September and October about whether it was in favour of full employment. It became a great issue between the left and right of the party. Of course they're in favour of full employment. Everybody's in favour of full employment. I just couldn't see why this was an issue. But of course what it is code for the question, do you think that nominal demand should expand more rapidly? because it's a kind of, you know, in the Labour Party, and I don't know if I detect this behind your question, I can't tell, but in the Labour Party, being in favour of full employment means in favour of a higher budget deficit, in favour of an easier monetary policy, in favour of a devaluation, just in favour of a standard Keynesian demand expansion. In order to believe in that, you've got to believe that the natural rate of unemployment in the labour market is a long way below where I think it is. And I think in the best analyses that come out of this place on that subject, the natural rate of unemployment is certainly below where we are now, but is not markedly below where we are now. The Nairu is not markedly below where we are now. And the last time we attempted to reduce unemployment markedly below the estimates of the Nairu that Steve Nicol and others produce, we had inflation. Inflation did take off. So unless you believe that the Nairu has gone down really quite substantially since the late 1980s, you must, I think, agree that the amount of scope for reducing unemployment through demand management policies is relatively limited. I mean, there's probably some scope, but it's relatively limited. And the real question is, how do you reduce the Nairu? Now, it may well be that benefit policy is relevant to this, but if so, I pass on that subject. I mean, it's a crucial question, but it just doesn't happen to be something I really know about. That's the normal question I get. I mean, that's a more normal question for me, actually, so I feel happy with that question. Go back to this blue document, turn to page 4. The little table at the bottom of page 4, table 3, shows estimates. Now, these should be treated with the usual health warning, but it shows estimates of the impact on GDP growth in any year of the fiscal policy tightening that is now due to take place and the monetary policy easing which has already happened. So this assumes no more monetary policy easing. Now if you look at the bottom right of this table, what it says is that the fiscal policy tightening next year will reduce GDP growth by 1.5%, then in the following 2 years by 0.5% in each year. But that will actually be offset almost completely, in fact slightly more than offset, by the lagged effects of the base rate cuts that we've already had. So if this is in any way anywhere near accurate, which it almost certainly isn't, but it gives you a kind of broad feeling for the magnitudes, perhaps, it indicates that although there is this big fiscal tightening coming, the continuing lagged effects of the monetary easing should offset maybe all of it, maybe slightly more, maybe less, but in that order of magnitude should offset a good deal of that fiscal tightening. So I think the case for a really substantial further cut in interest rates down to 3% or 2% is not all that strong if these models are anywhere near right. On the other hand, if I were the Chancellor, I'd be feeling a little nervous about the question we had earlier about consumption. I would certainly not want the recovery to peter out at this point because I couldn't see any inflation reason for allowing that to happen. So I think I would tend to err towards more monetary easing in order to make sure I have offset the fiscal tightening. I think I'd probably cut base rates again by a point quite soon, leave them at 4.5 for a bit. But I don't myself think that a cut to 2% or 3% is likely to be necessary to keep the domestic demand growth rate going. Now, on the bond market, what we have seen in country after country in the last few years is as short-term interest rates have been cut, you occasionally will get a short-term response, adverse response in the bond market. Sometimes the long bond yield will rise for a week or two. As people say, as the market says, this reduces counterinflation credibility. But then almost without exception, in fact, I think without exception, the cuts in the short rates have eventually fed through to the long rate as well. And you have seen the long end of the bond market rallying. You've seen lower yields at the long end of the bond market as short rates have come down. There's been some tendency for the curves to steepen, the yield curves to steepen, but the long end of the bond market has seen lower yields. And I think what has been happening is that bond yields around the world have been, bond yields and central banks have been adjusting slowly to the reality of very low inflation rates around the world. And what has tended to happen is that as the central banks have cut short rates, the bond markets have said, okay, they're easing monetary policy, but that's appropriate because inflation is so low, and the long bonds have then followed. If you want to view a long bond as the discounted total of future short rates, then what the market has said, as the short rate has come down, the market has said, okay, that's probably going to stay, the short rate's probably going to stay low for a relatively prolonged period of time because the inflation rate looks so low. I think the same may happen again. If the UK cuts the short rate to 4.5, I would be willing to bet a lot of money that over a 6-month period you'd get the long bond yield down, probably quite markedly.
Which is, you've painted a picture of an economic policy which is coherent, but I think one of the big questions about it is whether it's politically credible, in that you're having a significant fiscal squeeze over the next 2 or 3 years, higher taxes, lower government spending, coupled also with a real depreciation, which is shifting the terms of trade against UK and raising import prices relative to the price of our own goods. So that means real incomes are falling. And that's not a very politically attractive thing to do in the run-up to an election. So I think there must be real question marks over whether the government will actually go through with it.
Yeah. The last government that tried this in Britain was I suppose we had this imposed on us to some degree in 1976 to 79, when there was a fiscal tightening, a devaluation, an improving trade position from an adverse position. But a closer analogy is 1967 to 70, when under Roy Jenkins, much the same economic policy was followed when Jenkins was Chancellor of the Exchequer. In both 1970 and 1979, it resulted in defeat for the then Labour government on both in both cases. And I mean, there must be question marks certainly here whether this kind of policy is going to be sustainable, because as Charlie says, the workforce here, the electorate, gets less than the fruits of its labour over the next 3 or 4 years. It's probably going to be a policy which is good for profits, and it's almost certainly going to be a policy which means greater net exports than would otherwise take place, but that means less consumption. So there's no question that is true. I think the area where it is most likely to crack is on public spending, because I haven't mentioned public spending much, but if you look at the public spending numbers that lie behind this arithmetic, they're remarkably tight. And you've got public spending in real terms growing at approximately zero 2 years, minus one and then plus one. And then after that, at only 1% per annum in real terms, it's going to be very, very hard indeed to impose that constraint. So I think you have to have some doubts whether the government can actually do this. But in my mind, that actually increases the case for announcing measures now which are going to raise revenue. Because if you are dubious whether they can control government spending and government borrowing in a pre-election period, it increases the case for doing something now. Somebody said to me this morning that I've only been recommending this policy because I want the Tories to lose the next election.
Very good news on which.